Okay, I didn't know that so many people were afraid of dimensional reduction. But in combination with Martin Luther King Day, everybody seems to have scattered. But I hope, nevertheless, that we can have a good discussion on the topic that I would like to present, which I call real-time dimensional reduction. It is an approach to understand the classical approximation of field theory, a topic, of course, that is very main to this workshop. There are very practical reasons to study this regime. Quantum field theory is, of course, a very complicated theory, and one is always looking around for regimes where some simplifications may happen, for example in weak coupling, or also very familiar, you can try to do hydrodynamics, also a regime where in some sense the theory simplifies. And then there is now the classical regime, which should apply when the temperature is very high. The description of ordinary dimensional reduction very much hinges on the Euclidean description of field theory, and dimensional reduction then means that there is really a reduction in dimensions from 4 to 3. Real-time dimensional reduction is not a dimensional reduction in that sense. Let me say that in the outset. In the end, it is what you expect. Classical equations of motion for the fields that propagate in real time. But because, at least in the way I present it, there is such a very close connection to the static dimensional reduction, I call this real-time dimensional reduction, but if one is opposed to that, I won't quibble. I had in mind the following in my presentation. Because there is such a close connection with dimensional reduction for static quantities, I first would like to give a brief overview of what has happened there, especially the last few years. And then, in the second part of my talk, I would like to come to real-time dimensional reduction, but I hope that I can go through that fairly quickly, because much of what I have to say I can link up with static dimensional reduction. The main method that I will be using is the constraint effective action, and that is where my approach centers on. But at the same time, I would like to say from the outset that it is more in emphasis that this is different than that there is a big gap between the other approaches to real-time, to the calculation of real-time correlation functions that has been presented here at this workshop. In fact, I realized that that at the end of the transparency, I simply should go on the next one and mention everybody that somehow has been involved in this workshop as far as non-equilibrium and classical correlation functions is concerned. But first I will start with the applications of static dimensional reduction, and I in particular then want to link up with the developments of the last few years presented by Braat and Nieto and by the group of Caio Coyanti in various with various collaborators. The motivation for static dimensional reduction, I think, is very well explained in the two abstracts of really the starting papers on this subject. The paper by Kingspark and the paper by Appelquist and Pizarski that is always quoted. Everything really is there, I think. In the quote from Ginspark, it is mentioned that the critical behavior of certain theories can be isolated in an effective 3D theory of the zero frequency mode, whose Lagrangian may be calculated explicitly in weak coupling theory. Because that is what dimensional reduction is about. You try to find an effective theory that you can calculate, at least partly calculate, in weak coupling theory. And the application that Ginspark had in mind was phase transitions. On the other hand, Applequist and Pizarski, they look at the high temperature limit of QCD, and there they argue that for very slowly varying observables, it's reasonable to expect that there also is a dimensional reduction to a theory that lives in 3D. The picture that underlies all this is a very appealing one. If one looks at four-dimensional quantum field theory as living in a box with d minus one spatial dimensions and one Euclidean dimension, then one could expect that for phenomena that have large fluctuations, large compared to this basic length beta h bar, that for such phenomena the system somehow gets squeezed into the remaining spatial dimension. You have then to make sure, of course, that the physics that you're studying is really the physics of these large of these slow variations. But if you can argue that, then you perhaps might end up with a simplified theory that only lives in the t minus one dimension. And there are two cases where you expect this to occur. I'll refer back again to these two abstracts. One is when the correlations grow to infinity in a second order phase transition, that might a regime where this happens. And the other is when the frequencies go to zero, or when the temperature is going to infinity, which one could call the classical limit. In both these limits, one might expect something to happen here. As I said, this whole picture hinges on the fact that for static quantum field theory, the basic partition function that you would like to calculate, the trace over the canonical ensemble, that you can write this trace as a path integral over fields that are defined on imaginary time axis, constrained between the value 0 and beta times h bar. I've tried as much as possible to put in h bar because it's quite relevant for a classical limit. I'm not absolutely sure that I have been totally consistent, but at least I gave it a try. It's quite hard, in fact, to find where all these h bars have to go when you're not used to putting them in.
That's why we put that to one.
Okay, so the basic this is the basic formula that one starts from, and the quantity that one has to be calculated is the thermodynamic potential, or the logarithm of the partition function. Already in the 80s, Kapusta, for example, have given perturbative calculations for the free energy. But especially the last few years, Brat and Yeto have shown how to use dimensional reduction to split up the calculation of the partition function really into two problems. One is a separation into the static modes and calculating that part first, and then perturbative corrections on that. I will come back to that later. Just to establish the notation, we're living on the Euclidean contour, which means that I can extend everything in a discrete Fourier series with the well-known Matsubara frequencies, which are even in M for bosons and odd for fermions. The Feynman rules can be easily translated if you start with in Minkowski space to the Euclidean space by, in effect, everywhere replacing the integral over the energy by a summation over all the Matsubara frequencies. In this picture, dimensional reduction is really very simple. It amounts to the fact that in principle you have to take this summation over all Matsubara frequencies, but in static dimensional reduction the only thing you do is keep this one mode at the origin, which is called the static mode. And you try to reduce the prescription in such a way that only this one mode matters. That is a bit naive to hope that that will work out, but we will see how the story goes. I will confine myself to 5^4 theory this morning for the example. This afternoon, Bert-Jan will go to SUN and discuss the tricky things like gauge invariance, etc. I will dodge all these fundamental problems and concentrate on 5^4 theory, which brings out some other aspects quite clearly, especially in what regime you could trust dimensional reduction, for example, and what type of corrections you have to take into account to make it work. In this scalar model, I have only one field. I expand the field in Matsubara frequencies, and I will call the mode with n equal to 0 the static mode. And basically what I am then interested in is calculating correlation functions at different spatial points between this zero mode. So I introduce a generating functional by adding a source term coupled to the field, but the source term I take only with a spatial dependence. That means that the integral over the imaginary contour only applies here to the field, and that means that I integrate out all modes except the mode zero. So the field only couples to the zero mode, and I calculate then the correlation functions in principle by taking functional derivatives. I would also like to mention that you can define an order parameter, like Donner and Jackie for this model, as the average of this zero frequency field, and you can study a broken symmetry with that. I will only mention that in passing, how that can be incorporated. That will not be my main goal here. But in principle, that is included also in the description. Now, while you hope that you can confine yourself to only the static mode, is, for example, illustrated by the free correlator. If you write down the free correlator between the various modes, because then you see that it is given by a correlation function that drops off exponentially with a correlation length that is basically given by h bar over the temperature. So all modes, all non-static modes are screened except the static one, for which this correlation is, of course, infinite. And what you now hope to see later on in the theory is that when you are confining yourself to slowly varying phenomena that can be described by the zero mode, that indeed everything drops out of the theory and you are only having an effective theory that works for this static mode. and in the naive first papers on dimensional reduction that was stated as a fact. The tool now that I will use to derive static dimensional reduction is called the constraint effective action or average effective action. It has, of course, a very close connection with the action that Christoph has used in earlier papers, but I refer here to the original papers of Fukuda and Kyriakopoulos, and also Robert A. Wipf and Yoriyama, where they introduce the constraint effective action in field theory, I must say, because this idea really has been exploited many times in statistical physics. You could even say that when you do this well-known derivation going from the canonical ensemble to the microcanonical ensemble by introducing then a delta function that keeps first your energy fixed, and you do then later on the integral over the energy, is an example of a constraint effective action. The microcanonical ensemble is a constraint effective action, one could say. But in this context, it is introduced as follows. We define the zero mode as a sort of projection of the complete field on the zero frequency mode. I use a normalization here. And I define then this the zero mode as this projection of the full field. And what the constraint effective action now does for you is that it first integrates out formally over all other degrees of freedom, keeping this static mode that you're mostly interested in to the last. And you do that formally by introducing in functional delta function that sets this field equal to the static mode. And if you are able to do this formal integration, you will be given a theory that only depends on the mode that you are interested in. And this quantity that I denote by U is called the constraint effective action. It's formally correct, but as with all formal things that are correct in principle, you have to find out whether it is of any use, of course. And we will see whether that formal thing helps us here. And I think it does.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the delta function. What does it mean?
The delta function?
Well,
you,
but if I look at the diamond bow, it seems to be an
identity. I define this field as the zero mode projection of the full field. So I keep only the zero mode, really. I define this field as the zero mode. Okay, and I do that here in the integral by setting here the zero mode, setting here this field phi, and this is then this definition.
This is just a question of writing. I mean,
yeah.
You should write another phi as the argument of
Q.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, you're right. Right. Really. Look at the details. Okay, but let's take this one as the definition for the zero mode as well for the constraint effective action. There is a close connection with the usual effective action, and I will mention that in a minute. But first, look at what this constraint effective action gives you in principle. It makes it possible to write formally the full partition function of the theory as an integral over the one mode you're interested in with some probability density given by the constraint effective action. And in fact, this is, if you are allowed to do these formal manipulations, you have to the integral over phi, you have to bring you have to interchange limited, etc., and infinite integrals, of course. So it's not exactly clear whether you can make this rigorous, but if you are, for example, and then you can interchange the integrations, and then this integral will give you the full theory back. Nothing has been lost by introducing this formal thing. At the end, of course, one has to do approximations, but one of the points I would like to make in my talk is that it is best to keep these approximations to the very last. So I will keep working with this constraint effect of action. Now the relationship with the ordinary effect of action, that you can find, for example, in the following way. Replace this delta function by its integral representation and put that in. Then you can write, still formally exact, the constraint effect of action as a sort of Fourier transform. J is now some other field of the partition function. Fourier transformed with respect to this phi. I should have written, of course, here capital. I'm sorry. Because it's just writing here an integral form for the delta function, putting that in, and doing them first this integral. From here you can formally introduce a source, and this is the source term that appears in here.
Three-dimensional,
because everything is now spatial. I'm only looking at spatial dependence, so J has only a spatial dependence.
J is the dummy variable.
Dummy variable of
the
delta function, and here should be, of course, capital instead. Capital phi, yeah, mistake. Right? And the integral that you then have to do is, of course, the integral over the ordinary action, which is, by definition, the partition function, written fancily here as e to the logarithm. This gives you immediately the connection with the ordinary effect of action if you are allowed to use a mean field approximation or the stationary phase approximation here. That you find out directly when you look at the corresponding definition of the usual effect of action. Defined by a Legendre transform with respect to the current that only depends on space. You introduce an additional field phi that you couple to the source, and then you demand that the derivative of this effective action with respect to the source gives zero. This essentially sets this field phi equal to the average field in the usual manner, and then you have the standard reciprocity relations between the effective action and the logarithm of the generating functional, which defines for you the vertex functions, etc., etc. Now the point is that you can get back to this well-known effective action from the constraint effective action if you are allowed to do the stationary phase approximation here for J, because if you take only the dominant term then from here, then you immediately find out that that is in fact the same as the Legendre transform here, or more in detail, this is the representation of the delta function that you put in. This is then again the formula that you formally derive. This time is the correct phi there, and there you see, doing the stationary phase approximation here gives you a connection between the constraint effect of action and the logarithm of z at a very particular point, namely exactly the point that you need to invert the relationship between phi and the j. And you assume that this will be correct in the infinite volume limit under normal circumstances, and by normal I mean that the correlation that the correlations in the system are finite, then you can show that for that case in the infinite volume limit you are indeed allowed to take only the dominant term into account, and you have the equality of the effective action and the constraint effective action. However, the point is of course that when you're close to a critical point that the correlations will grow, and then the connection between these two quantities is broken. And it is broken for the well-known reason that it is very difficult, you have to take care in defining effective action for a theory below the critical temperature, because as we know that the Legendre transform is then not well defined. Well, in principle the constraint effective action is defined above M as well as below a critical point. As I said, I will not go into detail here, but and I will confine myself really to the unbroken phase, but in principle this constraint effective action is also below the critical point a very useful quantity to consider. It works both ways, so you can get from the constraint effective action to the usual effective action in the stationary phase approximation as in the regime where that is allowed. You can also go the other way from the identity that I have shown you. You see that the logarithm of the partition function of the full theory can in principle be represented by an integral over phi, which I could call the order parameter of the constraint effective action, but I now use this identity to put the standard effective action in there. But since I'm only doing stationary phase approximation, I should do that here too, which that has been shown by Brandenberger. You can do very neatly by introducing a small parameter a here and there, and then doing stationary phase approximation means then that you go to the dominant order in small a. And if you do that again, then you find the inverse Legendre transform between the effective action and the partition function back, or stated differently, it's also a very nice way of demonstrating the relationship between vertex functions and ordinary Green's functions. This theory defines for you a new vertices from the effective action, in particular the two-point vertex function that is defined by this effective action is of course the standard full propagator, and the higher point functions are the one-particle irreducible vertex functions of the theory. Now taking the mean field approximation here, keeping only the dominant term in A, means that you only take the tree diagrams into account. So at the right-hand side, you have just a sum of three diagrams that you can make up out of the vertex functions defined by the effective action. And that, at the right-hand side, of course, when you expand it out with respect to G, you have your ordinary Green functions of the theory. And then you see here that what you get out in the field approximation from this formula that you get the standard expansion of Green's functions in terms of irreducible vertex functions, because you're only going to keep here the tree diagrams.
I mean, the relation between the standard Green functions and the one-party irreducible is, of course, independent of any approximation of such combinatoric. I mean, you would
yes.
any other thing. Whereas this type of stationary phase approximation, that amount essentially of neglecting the remaining functional integration of zero modes.
Right.
Is
and
that not a, I mean, in most of the cases of interest, integration over the zero modes is actually where the complicated physics is.
Right. So only when you are away from a critical point, say in an area of non-interesting physics, so to speak, something like that, then when the correlations length is finite, then you can do not when you do simply the expansion, take first the dominant term and then calculate the correction, then you immediately see that they are suppressed as long as there is a finite correlation length and as long as you are allowed to take the infinite volume limit. Then, and only then, this identity holds. Between constraints...
That tells you your reduced theory can be treated classically. That happens, of course, in some circumstances, but in the interesting cases it almost...
We will see about that. We will see about that. Anyway, this is only you're completely right, of course. The connection between ordinary Green functions and the vertex functions here, you can derive that in many ways, diagrammatically, whatever. But in the context of my presentation, I find this illuminating to see how you have from the let's say the exact integral over the last interesting modes by a mean field approximation, you get the usual relationship between Green's functions and vertex functions. It's just a particular way of presenting this relationship, but it also points out once again that the identity of the constraint effective action and the usual effective action only works in the classical regime. When you are allowed to do the mean field approximation.
I find this a bit confusing. As far as I understood it, the only the relation between the constraint effective action and then say Legendre transform effective action is exact in the infinite volume limit.
Right. Yes.
Because you still have the remaining interaction in the phase of the zero modes. Yeah, that can only be true in the stationary phase approximation where you treat the low frequency, the zero Mantovani frequency modes as classical. I mean, normally you still have to solve your three dimensional theory, let's say, when you're after dimensional.
Yeah, I made a mistake. In case I define it as a constant field in space,
yeah,
then
you're essentially done because there's no correlation. No non-trivial. The rest is almost special.
Perhaps this picture that I took from the original paper of
gravity.
Right, but still it helps, I think, to visualize the connection between the effective action and the constraint effective action. What is here is the partition function. As the logarithm of the partition function called W, as a function of volume, omega, and a source, G. And then, as long as this infinite volume is a smooth curve, you can define both the Legendre transform, which then gives you the effective action, and the constraint effective action. There's no problem with that. However, you know that when there is a broken symmetry, then this smooth pointed behavior in the origin will become discontinuous. That defines for you your broken phase, and the derivative is then not well defined. So you have a problem in constructing the Legendre transform, and the way it is then usually done is to introduce another form of the Legendre transform, sometimes called the Fengel transform, which basically does for you that above where the critical point everything is the same, but below what you do is making a flat effective action. So the effective action goes down to zero. In the critical region, it's flat and goes up again. That is what the Fengel transform does for you. The constraint effective action you can define above and below the critical point. Below the critical point, it actually gives you the sombrero hat. But in the infinite volume limits, also the sombrero hat flattens out. And just like the effective action, you get here this potential well with the lower parts cut off. I will not discuss phase transitions in particular, but this is only to illustrate that this is a useful thing to consider, and it is very well known in statistical mechanics. For example, if I allow to mention that briefly only, you can rewrite the Ising model in terms of a constraint effective action. For example, by defining an order parameter as the average of the spins at one size. It is a discrete model, but this order parameter average becomes a continuum field, and I could then introduce the partition function as a integral over the order parameter called the magnetization in this case, of course, and then the task is to calculate this constraint effective action, which gives you the probability for finding the system with a certain magnetization. I will not go into this, but I just want to establish a connection with standard statistical physics.
I mean, this is of course a perfectly valid transformation, but at this step, even once you have your effective action, you just have transformed it into an equivalent three-dimensional continuous theory that you still have to solve.
Of course.
It's different if your constraints only concern the constant field, where the remaining work is just a zero-dimensional theory that is almost trivially solved, or if you constrain it in a way that your remaining degrees of freedom still form a field theory, like here, a three-dimensional field theory that is still, in this case, as difficult to solve as the original one, in a sense. And even for the other integral form, if you go from 4 to 3, you still have a complicated three-dimensional
field. Right. It's only to establish a connection with standard theory. We are going to use this, of course, in the context of dimensional reduction, which means that we hope to be able to do perturbation theory. So let me come back to dimensional reduction and see how the constraint effective action then works here. At the object, as I have said, is now to calculate the constraint effective action, but then especially for the zero mode field, which I once again formally introduced by writing a delta function in the functional integral for the partition function. Now, because I know that this is the zero mode field, I can simply factorize the full integral in one of the zero modes and the rest. The integral of the zero mode I can perform, which simply brings this field phi into the action, and what remains is the functional integral over the non-static modes that I still have to perform. But in principle, the constraint effective action will then give me the functional dependence on this zero mode field. And as I write it here, this is an exact relationship, but we have to see what we can do with that. In the original Kingspan paper, it then goes on as follows. The action, you know, of course, for phi to the fourth theory, so you can work out what the splitting in a static and a non-static fields means. And of course, you then find out that you get three contributions. One is the Hamiltonian that only refers to the static field. You have a part, a free part, that only refers to the non-static fields. And of course, you get mixed contributions, the interaction between the static field and the non-static field. And this is just written out the phi to the fourth term for all the modes, but then putting here a prime which says don't take the zero mode into account in this sum. It has been So only the contribution where all these ends are zero has to be excluded. All the other combinations you have to take into account, of course. Now, it has been noted, especially by Georgine in 1984, that this looks like, if you write it in this way, as a field theory for an infinite number of fields, phi n, which have frequency, and that means masses that are of order of the temperature. And you could look at this field theory as one that contains a light mode, a mode with the zero mass, or the mass that is contained in the original Lagrangian, plus an infinite set of fields that carry a mass that is at least of order of the temperature. And you hope that by taking the temperature large enough, these heavy modes, as they are called, will decouple and leave you with a much simpler theory. Before we go to that, we first rewrite it perturbatively, because that is the idea behind dimensional reduction, namely that by treating the static modes separately, that you get rid of your infrared divergences, and that the remainder of what you have in your constraint effective action, that part at least can be treated perturbatively. That is the main interest of dimensional reduction, really. And that's exactly what then is being done. This functional integral over the non-static fields is treated perturbatively in the usual manner, which means that you write it as a sum of the zero, let me say, as the free partition function of the non-static modes that is indicated by this. That is, of course, a Gaussian integral, and you can do that. That's the standard integral leaving out the static modes, plus all the interactions, which are here written as a sum of connected diagrams in the theory, because if you do perturbation theory, you have a propagator that is now non-static, because you explicitly have left out the static modes, so the only modes you have to sum over are the non-static modes, which at least have the temperature as a mass, and you have all these interactions to take into account, which are in this case basically free, namely the interaction between the non-static modes themselves, and then two interactions with the static field, one linear and one quadratic. In principle, there should be also, of course, a interaction between three static fields and one non-static, but that, because of energy, the energy constraint cannot happen, so that one will not occur in the theory. And if you want to do calculate constraint effective action perturbatively, then what you're going to do is to calculate the one particle irreducible diagrams that you can construct on the basis of these interactions and this propagator, where always you have only the sum over the non-static modes. And that defines for you the vertex functions of the theory, because what you now have constructed is the following. The constraint effection action is the static part, plus the one loop contribution of the non-static modes, plus the remainder, which is a sum over one particle irreducible loop diagrams that you have to calculate. And that makes up the total constraint effective action. Until this point, we have not really lost anything, except that we have introduced the idea that it must be possible to calculate things perturbatively. But because of its generality, it is of course also totally useless in this form, and one needs some kind of approximation to make this work. And what then is the usual argument is the following. You only have now non-static loop diagrams in your theory, and they define the vertex functions to arbitrary order. But because the dangerous static mode has been subtracted, everything has a mass, and the mass is of the order of the temperature. And at high temperature, you expect that everything will be dominated by powers of the temperature. And you find then out very easily that the power that goes with a certain vertex function is essentially given by the superficial degree of divergence of the diagrams, because only the temperature is really a scale in the high temperature limit. So you have that's the main factor that comes in. But for every loop in finite temperature field theory, you have an additional temperature. So the total behavior of a vertex function is according to its expansion coefficient and the coupling constant. Then the temperature, to the loop order because of the summation, and then this d, and you can reword it with well-known relationship between vertex functions, etc., into this simple formula that gives you the behavior with temperature of any vertex function to the order n. And you see that except for the first two, the tadpole at higher orders for the self-energy, and the coupling constant, everything is expected to be suppressed by powers of the temperature. And the hope is that basically you can get away with only these first approximations, these one loop approximations to the vertex functions, which would mean of course an enormous reduction in complexity. But, and that has also been realized quite a number of years ago, it's not that simple as you might hope. There are a number of problems introduced at this stage in dimensional reduction. And they are of three kinds. I mentioned them here. New ultraviolet divergences occur. You have to take into account hard thermal loops, and there is the non-locality problem. Let me go through them, starting with these divergences. Of course it's so, still, that as far as the vacuum renormalization is concerned, that you can renormalize the theory by the standard vacuum theory counterterms. That does not change, but what changes is that I am now constructing the 3D effective theory, and this 3D effective theory, being classical theory, will need a cutoff to make it finite. A cutoff, let's say, of the order of the temperature. Otherwise, you get divergence integrals.
But now, this cutoff, is it the ultraviolet cutoff or infrared cutoff?
No, it's the ultraviolet cutoff that you need to, for example, to make the classical energy finite. You have the Rayleigh Jeans catastrophe here, of course, because it's a classical theory, and you need a cutoff to make that finite.
But this is not in the way you present it to Nell, because the zero mode of the field has still arbitrary space dependence. So if you want to do the complete partition function, you still have to integrate over this arbitrary space dependence of the
zero mode. So
but the cutoff can be higher than the
Okay, I come to that, but
if you would put it on the last and if you would iterate the performance set exactly, then you would just find that the quadratic term is still a divergence, which is all 1 over 8.
Yeah, but the A we object to this lambda tilde t equation.
But
yeah,
that's
exactly.
But he needs.
No,
and
you
have to do something in order to achieve it.
But
if you would just do it, I mean, the procedure he described, this would be, this cutoff would be of the order of the original cutoff of your COP.
Yeah. So.
Which is four dimensional COP.
Yeah.
However, since you have in principle the full theory, there must be compensating counterterms somewhere to take this divergence into account, and that is exactly what you will find out. Especially Brat and Nieto have analyzed this very carefully, and they find that it's precisely so that indeed in your 3D theory certain divergences arise. You can regularize these, for example, in dimensional regularization, or to see really what happens with some cutoff, and what you then find out that the divergences in your effective theory are exactly cancelled by similar divergences that arise in the remainder of the theory. I will give an example that makes it perfectly clear in a minute. In any case, power divergences are not a problem at all in this respect, because in dimensionalization you can set them zero anyway. It's much more subtle to consider the logarithmic divergences. In principle, also there the same cancellation must occur, in principle, because I have not done anything at the moment. I have not really thrown away things. So when a divergence occurs in the effective theory, in the remainder somewhere, there must be the compensating a divergence. But as you see, the logarithmic term go with lambda over m in the full theory, and with a temperature over the cutoff in the effective theory, and somehow these two must then match so that the cutoff drops out and you get a logarithm of t over m or m over t, and that is of course a physical thing that you have to keep. So in principle that must work, but in practice it can be hard work really to find exactly what terms match with what terms. So that the divergences are not really the issue here, just the finite terms, exactly as you mentioned, to find exactly which finite terms you have to keep from this. That is the hard work.
I would say this deep relations are a bit because in the full theory it's log t divided by m, and this t comes from the ultraviolet, and the m comes from the infrared. So probably in the 3D theory you would have a log lambda divided by m.
But you know that in the effective theory you get this type of terms.
Do you know? I mean, I would think from the
In the effective theory has only the temperature as but that mixes up then with the hard thermal loops because that is then
the
naively you might think that this effective 3D theory would be massless, but that's not the case as everybody knows. And that comes because there are certain one-loop diagrams that give a contribution that is as large as the classical contribution, and you simply have to keep this. And in the fight of the fourth theory, luckily there is only one term that comes from the tadpole, and then that is one term that you have to keep, and that is not really a headache. The only thing that really happens is that you had hoped perhaps to get an effective theory that you could expand in order z squared, but you find then out that you have only an expansion in to order g. Non-locality in a minute.
Well, in other words, the main expansion you had with the vertex function breaks down.
Breaks down. You have to correct. You have certainly to correct for that.
And the expansion that was written down was for integration out.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. This is not a problem because then you have effective mass for the temperature.
But I also wrote down the order of g, and I will come to that in a moment.
Is that only the one loop?
Yeah. That's
two point and 4.5.
In this constraint effective action.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So they have. Out of the nullzero maximum, you have an effective mass for the temperature, which dominates this induced loss of the thermal mass. So it is cut off below by the temperature, not by the thermal mass. So you don't have, you still have the expansion in G squared.
Yeah, let me.
That wasn't the point I was making on that.
Fine, I will come back to
it. In the Gauss theory, you have hard thermal loops from all the vertex functions. The naive power counter is not quite correct.
I think what he's saying is, yeah, it is correct for the non-maximal, for the non-zero mode. You still have an expansion in G squared.
Yes, but
you have to separate the other problems come from the on the first set from going. Let's call it from 4 to 3 dimensions. That is the main application. So you just integrate out the non-zero maximal frequencies. Then there is no particular problem. I mean, there are no divergences. And the other problems only arise when you treat the three-dimensional theory. Right. I mean, you do not. There is no problem with Debye masses and something like that. These are anyhow small compared to T. In the first set, the only escape you have is really T.
Yeah, but. In final instance, when you're really at the end of it, you conclude still the dimensional reduction is only going to work as an expansion in terms of G. That
but that is not open.
I bet, yeah. Right.
If you would give it to the computer, this three-dimensional theory, you wouldn't have to talk about thermal.
Oh, that is nice. The computer does not recognize this? Okay, but I come back to it in a minute.
Three or four different things are being
For the static. But
yeah.
Now one of the things is, can you get away for
the
right.
Not okay.
That has to do with the whether you can get away with local vertex functions, and it has been argued very convincingly the last few years that is not so, and that you have somehow to take non-localities into account, and the way to do this is called matching. I come back to that in a second. the Hartzell loops, then nothing new here, only to indicate where they come from, and also that they provide immediately the appropriate counter terms for your theory. The one loop self energy consists of the static part that you would get out of your static theory plus the non-static part. I have separated that explicitly here. For mass equal to zero, you can do, of course, all these calculations. They are how to do these summations, etc., is well known, of course. What I've done here is use analytic continuation to calculate the sum, and then you find that this non-static part is given by what you would expect for the thermal mass in this case, except that the Bose distribution function here is now the Bose distribution function, but with a subtraction, namely exactly the zero mode subtracted from here. That's the only thing that that happens in the calculation of the tadpole. But that, of course, indicates precisely what you are going to expect. Calculating non-static vertex functions, you will encounter Bose distribution functions, and in each of these Bose distribution functions, you have explicitly to extract this zero mode term. That introduces, of course, in this case, a linear divergence. Here it is. For which you need in principle then a cutoff, but you know, because you have subtracted something here that is coming back later on there, that in the end result things will cancel out completely. So what is going to happen? I will also illustrate it for the two loop case, is that in all the effective vertex functions that you're going to keep, they are dependent on a cutoff. Perhaps best to keep this cutoff here and not put it equal to zero too early. And that is constructed, the theory is constructed in such a way that if we now calculate a static diagram that has certain ultraviolet divergences, then I know that the counter terms that I get from here will in the end precisely counter cancel against the other divergences. That's the way the theory is set up, and the only thing you have to worry about really is when you're doing approximations whether this consistency is kept intact.
And so, and the cutoff kind of will be taken to infinity?
Because it cancels out. That is a major point that Gert and Jan have made, is that if all these cutoffs are going to cancel anyway, then you can take this cutoff to infinity. You don't need to, that was the point Jan was making just a bit earlier, there is no need to put this somewhere around the temperature, because it is irrelevant anyway. So, Hartzell loops and ultraviolet divergences are taken into account. The only thing that really is a problem now, still, that is whether a local approximation to this dimensionally reduced theory makes any sense. Let me remind you here what has been derived in dimensional reduction. What has been derived is the following. You want to calculate basic static correlation functions, if you could, in the full theory. But what you now have reduced the theory to, without making any approximations, is that you write these correlation functions as a functional integral with a certain weight, which is given by the constraint effect of action. And in principle, this is exact. And if you could work with this constraint effective action in general, you would have exact dimensional reduction, so to speak. But, of course, this constraint effective action is a highly complicated, non-local, infinite functional, etc., etc. And it will do you no good at all, except in cases where you really can make it work for you and do and substantially simplify it. And the major ansatz that the last few years is now used to simplify this is to start off from the beginning by assuming that it is possible to simplify this highly non-local functional to some constant term that is not of interest here, plus an effective theory which is constructed in such a way that it is local by construction, that it is compatible with the symmetries. So you include, in fact, in this effective Lagrange everything that you expect to occur. And then you treat these parameters that come in here as sort of phenomenological parameters that you have then to fit to to the observables that you would like to measure. To my mind, this is very similar to what you do in statistical mechanics when you go from a fundamental theory to a reduced description, for example, to describe a phase transition. Because what you do then is you have your complicated microscopic theory, and what you put on top of it is an ansatz, for example, the Ginzburg-Landau ansatz, that it is possible to reduce your theory in a certain regime of low energies by an effective theory, which is given in this case by the effective Ginzburg-Landau theory. And we know that for certain type of phase transitions this works marvelously, as long as you know how to fit these coupling constants that are in here to certain susceptibilities that you can actually measure. Or you can even integrate out the fluctuations and go to the Landau theory as originally formulated by Landau for second order phase transitions, which is given in terms of an expansion in the constant order parameter with certain parameters that has to be gotten out of experiment or fitted somehow to things you know.
And the difference here is that here you know when the theory works well, it's known to work well in certain situations. And you know it works well because it fits experiments. The Landau Ginzburg theory, we know it fits experiments.
Yes.
But you wouldn't know a theory whether this first step going from micro to what was a good step? You wouldn't know.
But you have to find out through experiment in the end, I think.
Or
by doing computer experiments, of course, but...
For example, the computer experiment you use the fingerness detection theory in your computer experiments.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have no real control or anything.
Maybe I may also make a comment to that. This matching is the method that is really mainly used in practice. It works whenever you can either rely on three-dimensional universality, so that you have, even within your three-dimensional theory, really long-range correlations, because couplings in three dimensions run very fast typically. So if you can use universality, you just have to match a few functions, and then you have a very good approximation already. The second thing where it works is when you have small coupling, because when you have a small coupling, then the actual non-local terms that you are not including in your three-dimensional action are just suppressed. You can still fix a few of your couplings that match in the corrections, and then are then really higher order. But in a situation where the typical length scale, the characteristic length scale of the physics, is not much smaller than, the temperature in this case, and you have no small couplings, for example, that would be relevant for QCD, I do not see any direct way of
verifying this, no.
Of controlling the neglected terms. There is no real reason why it should be affected below the parameters.
And it has been used exactly in the cases that you hope that you can get away with perturbation theory, in the electro Fourier description of the electroweak transition that has been the work of the last few years of course, the Chianti group to do this.
I mean, will not work right around the phase transition.
No, but they first they do it and reduce it to two steps.
No, for weak coupling, it also works in first order phase transition. As long as the coupling is weak and the neglected terms can be argued to be suppressed by powers of the coupling, and higher dimensional field combinations are suppressed by. But
still, the step is first to go to an effective Lagrangian, which mimics the constraint effective action as a local expression, and try to find conditions how to fit these now not really known coefficients here, also scaling coefficient, to something. And what is used especially by Brad and Nieto is a matching. If you write it like this, you have three unknown parameters here: a mass, a coupling, and a scale. And you want somehow to know what these are, and because they are connected to 2-point and 4-point functions, it seems reasonable to try to match them on the level of the 2-point and the 4-point self energies. You have a choice here. Well, I have no fundamental argument that these are really the only possibilities for doing the matching, but anyway, it seems reasonable and it works for the applications that it is used for.
Can you think about this first step in systematic expansion?
In the following sense, that when the coupling is small, it all comes down finally to when the coupling. The coupling.
But this is in an extreme high temperature phase that this works, right?
Yeah.
If you have an asymptotic degree theory and I need a weak coupling.
Weaker.
This is going to be true in 5-4 theory.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
If the coupling at that temperature scale is weak, then it should work.
So I go above the phase transition, but not too far above where
the transition even. But you still are left with your.
There were statements that as I go through.
You know, this type of normalization for conditions at k equals 0, you better do not use near the phase transition, because then you will not get a good matching. I mean, just near the phase transition, for example, 4-point function will be better options, typically, and things like that. I mean, when you want to consider phase transition, use the normalization conditions which are at higher momentum.
The point
is not only useful at very high temperatures above the phase transition. You can also use slightly below
if you do the matching, not at zero momentum.
And also the temperature that where you are going to at what temperature you are going to use, this is also a point of discussion. But anyway, the matching conditions give you a relationship between things that you can in principle calculate in your 4D theory and the effective self energy that you would get out of your static theory, and these things should, up to a certain order in the coupling constant, should match, which means that it gives you an expression for these unknown coefficients in the coupling constant. For two loops, for example.
If I may come back to this, what is usually calculated is the difference between the original theory and the reduced theory, and that I thought it was infrared finite, but then you can choose k or 0 as a matching point. But
you see already in question number 4, the finite is 4 coupling at the transition at the critical temperature of the
Yeah,
because k0 is
called the zero.
In the reduced theory, but in the difference between the reduced theory and the full theory, there, you know, in diagrams.
Yeah, but in diagram, but you still have to be careful. That's the argument of Blatt and Nieto, anyway. That both are divergent, but they are divergent in the same manner. Perhaps
let me get it straight. It is true, of course, that both the mass and the Floppy cup, they go to zero. For example, they go to zero if you are at a critical point in a fixed ratio. So there is no way of using that as a normalization condition because it is given by the fixed point behavior of the critical of the Wilson-Fischer fixed point.
No, but in your diagrams, if you just calculate in diagrams the difference between the reduced theory and the full theory.
But any diagrammatic expansion will break down, of course.
No, it shouldn't break down.
I think.
I mean, it's a highly non-conformative phenomenon.
You take the full theory and you take the reduced theory. You have the same infrared behavior which governs the phase transition. So if you look at the difference, you subtract out the regime which governs the phase transition and look at the difference, then that difference disturbs it. And that should be made small in the measure.
And anyway, how it is done? You have in your affected theory of. Perhaps we need a coffee break in a little while, huh?
Whenever you're.
Okay.
You're going to.
Let's finish this and then.
Time.
Yeah. Then at a certain point. I will get to it. How one works this for the two in the case of two loops is as follows. From the effective theory, you only have these diagrams because you have only static diagrams, and the effective theory is only about static fields. But the mass and the coupling constant are now free parameters, and they have to be fitted in such a way that it reproduces the full theory as best as possible. And how that is done is by writing down the diagrams of the full theory, separated in the static contributions and the non-static contributions. And then, of course, you see immediately that the full theory also generates static diagrams, and they should then cancel out against the static diagrams of the effective theory. But some of the non-static diagrams remain, and they have to be fitted into the coupling constants that you have. And what you then find out, for example, for the mass, is that you get a correction. The mass is just the in leading order, just the thermal mass. But there is a coupling constant correction that has been worked out by Braten and Nieto in great detail, and it looked like this has the expected dependence on a cutoff over the temperature. Anyway, this is the way it is used. The choice of temperature where you do this is, I think, an issue. And in fact, looking at these matching relations, you could consider writing down flow equations for these matching relations as you go with temperature, not with the scale, with the temperature. And that is, in fact, something that we have done in Amsterdam. Studied these relationships as function of the temperature, and I won't go into any detail here, but this is what you find for these coupling constants here in an unbroken phase, and then you see that essentially the coupling constant of the effective theory goes to some sort of a constant. One is a normalization on the zero temperature mass and coupling constant, and that the thermal mass essentially rises with temperature, as you expect. But you can also do this for a broken phase, and then you find that somewhere the mass is going to zero and the coupling constant is going to zero at the critical point, which is given by critical temperature, which is three or four times the effective mass at temperature zero. So you can study how this behaves at various temperatures, and you see that you can, by choosing the correct initial conditions, get out the phase transition.
The thing you want to describe by is that central column.
Yes, we have worked closely together with
the
Yeah, right, right, right. It, is, it did grow out of a collaboration with Chris and Danjo. Right. Strictly within. These are the parameters that define your 3D theory, and for these, the matching relations that I write down for these, I need for that the full 4D theory, because I need an expression between the effective coefficients and the coupling constants of the original theory.
I think what would be helpful is to have a clear statement, like exactly under what conditions I expect this matching to work, and under what conditions it will break down.
Okay, both perhaps this then helps. This is assuming that you. This is to try and to argue how far you can go by including only these local terms in an expression that you know is in principle non-local, because if you take an expression like this and make it dimensionless by using essentially the scale of the thermal mass, and using also the earlier estimate for the vertex functions, that they are suppressed by this power of the temperature, then you can rewrite the effective action in a dimensionless form with coupling constants that are then also dimensionless. And then you immediately see that the fourth term will get a new coupling constant, as expected, of course, because I now use the thermal mass as a scale, which means that the effective coupling constant of the theory will now be G instead of G squared. But it also gives you an estimate of all the other terms that you have been neglecting, all the gradient terms that you did not include, and all the higher orders in the field that you did not include. And the coupling is basically the expression given here. The temperature drops out completely if you do it in this way, and all the higher coupling constants are given by the original constant, the coupling constant, to a certain power. So for example, when you take n is 6 and no gradients, so 5 to the power 6 term, then it will give you, that starts at g to the power 6. That's also a term that has been calculated explicitly by Klaas Landsman. But in fact, the term with a fourth power and two gradients in it is more dominant, because that starts off at g to the fifth. And that has been included in calculations by
Bradley. Are you saying these are all irrelevant operators?
They are all irrelevant operators as long as the coupling constant is small enough. So the dominant ones are indeed these ones, provided that nothing happens that is overlooked in this dimensional argument.
Exactly, that proviso.
But the explicit calculations of
it's not straightforward, because the thermal mass is temperature dependent.
Yes.
So that's why everything is in the end expressed in terms of coupling constants, and as not and in terms, if you would think of irrelevant operators, you would think it would be down like powers of t.
Yes.
But since t also comes in the zero mode as a thermal mass, it's a bit more involved, and in the end everything is expressed in powers of coupling constants. Well, in that sense, it's the mean.
Okay, so what is this quantity here, Feynman?
This one?
No,
this one?
Yeah. What is this ratio?
This is the inverse thermal mass.
C is the inverse thermal mass?
Yeah, so it gives you the correlation. The typical correlation, this is basically the thermal mass that comes into the effective theory, and I use that to scale everything. I scale the field with that. I scale the spatial distance. I scale with that. I define a new variable y. And if I do that, then I see that I get dimensionless coupling constants that are entirely given by some power of the coupling original coupling constant. And you can check this at least in a number of orders explicitly, and that has been done by Brat and Nieto.
But if those are has no count of
Higher order in the effective theory. In the effective theory.
But then the mu t is of course not yet the one of the mu t is not the correlation then. I mean.
You expect corrections on
no,
that.
I expect, for example, mu t squared to be negative, even if you are in the symmetric space slightly above the phase transition. I mean, of course, so the three dimensional contribution to it. I mean, which is.
But at sufficiently high temperature, you don't expect this to be negative.
Now we're back to sufficiently
high temperature. But then you're very high above
the
space.
That's a question.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know. I
think there's always okay. Elaboration around the base of it.
Well, the phase transition. No, I refer simply to this picture where you see that you don't need to be too far out from your phase transition to make this in a linear relationship with temperature. So, it's not asymptotically out. I would get. Okay.
But Chris, the argument is about the applicability of the effective theory as for below the phase and around the phase. Even if it's the first for the phase. As far as I understand it ought to be able. You ought to be able to apply it there too, as long as the coupling is weak.
Weak. Right. Yeah.
It's a bit confusing because the general formula, the way it's presented, seems to make no assumptions at all. I mean, if one does it exactly, or one has a strict weak coupling constant used to expand, it seems to have no restriction. Yet,
if I do fourth,
I'm not doing these calculations myself. I'm aware that there are lots of papers where people are discussing all these quantities, and you know it's not so trivial at all. So I just would like we should have perhaps a very clear statement.
Okay, here's the statement.
Arnold,
let's finish up with that.
Example, is not here now, but
yeah, but all gauge theories. Yeah, right. And there are different scales involved. And it's really more complicated. It's really more complicated. And Bertjan is going to talk about this afternoon.
This is
strictly confined to 5 to the 4th theory, where there's really only one scale that comes in, the thermal mass, that you have to take into account.
It's a statement for static quantities in a weakly coupled theory, not a gauge theory. It's important that it not be a gauge theory.
Yes, especially
because...
Always work, because this is the final command. Dimensional reduction for this theory always works when the coupling constant is small. That is what the statement is. Even in cases that you have in your finite temperature field theory terms that blow up with the mass. That is precisely what you have in your effective theory. Things go wrong in the classical limit because this becomes small, and then you have a breakdown of perturbation theory. That can happen in your effective theory. Still, the dimensional reduction to this effective theory is supposed to be valid as long as the coupling constant is small enough.
So all these complications that I and others here worried about are all in the three-dimensional theory.
Are all, that is the hope, that you have confined all your problems in the three-dimensional theory. And this statement is only to make you aware that that there is always an approximation involved in getting to this three-dimensional theory. You're throwing away orders of the coupling constant and also logarithms of the coupling constant.
That's in order to do the local matching.
Yes.
But if I didn't insist on that, if I had a lattice calculation or something,
And if you knew how to work with your phenomenological parameters, then you would expect this to work. But in this derivation, you see, you always will have dimensional reduction. If you confine it to a local approximation, you must always expect that there are correction terms. But luckily for you, in a weak theory, they should be only of this order and never of this order. This combination does not occur. Summarize.
To the total thing, to the total statement, I mentioned that reduction works for decoupling, I would immediately say yes. Still, I think the matching has to be taken with care. I mean, you should not always. I mean, once you start doing matching in a situation which is not perturbatively controlled anymore, you should really be. There are really problems that may appear. Whenever you do your matching at momenta or something like that, it's infrared controlled parameters so that these long range fluctuations do not play a role, then you're perfectly fine. And then once you have done your matching, you can, of course, perfectly compute even the phase transition. But choosing matching conditions at zero momentum, if you are very clever and you really have understood how the theory goes, you can do it.
But
in general, I mean, it's not possible.
The point is that if you calculate, say, in the full theory, perturbative, and in the reduced theory, also perturbative, in both cases you get all hell breaks loose when you try to match at k equals 0. Now you write down the diagrams for the difference, and there. You can just match for k equals 0. Because in the difference, it doesn't blow up. They both blow up. But in the difference, it doesn't blow up.
You should look really at the derivative of these matching conditions. So you should write down flow equations for these in terms of the temperature and in terms of the momentum scale. That is what you should do.
No, if you compute the difference, then I would agree. It's two different temperatures or something.
Right, and that is what I've shown you. When you do that, then you can run it with temperature.
But if you do the meshing at certain momentum, you can on both sides introduce infrared calculator. You see on both sides the same infrared divergence, okay? And the finite, the difference is the infrared finite. There's no problem. This is the same effect. So maybe that's the same as saying you should not match at k equals 0 on the
phase. Formally, at the loop level, it's probably wrong. But since perturbation theory is controlled neither for one nor for the other quantities, and you are subtracting two infrared diverging quantities, I would bet that if you do it badly, you can also do it. Then it really depends on how you precisely define your quantities. I would bet with you that if you define them in some odd way, you get knowledge.
You wouldn't trust your perturbative calculation if you also couldn't apply it everywhere. So you compare the two theories. You compare, say, the self-energy in the full theory and in the reduced theory. You take the difference. You need I think the formulation in infrared product is probably the best. So both, for each of them you need the infrared product, but in the difference, then you calculate it, then you see, this difference doesn't depend anymore on this infrared product. And that allows you,
always certain hand waving, because proof is a different thing, allows you to conclude that apparently the difference between these two theories is infrared intensity and can be calculated perturbative. The starting point, I agree, you both cases, the infrared doesn't hit you in the face, but okay, you just go on, take a cutoff, you have something fishy there, and, but then in the difference, you see it's intensity.
Right. And it gives
I only looked at it to one look. But people have done that as far as I mean, these, especially the Galeazzi group, have worked it all out on the level for two looks. And lying there as well, and they.
And you know, we know that even in history it works very nicely.
Because as long as this
exactly.
There is there, then it holds. That's the statement, really. Yeah?
There is, of course, very little empirical evidence. There are no experiments, they're computer experiments comparing 3D to 4D. And they compare very well, but the error bars are not visible in the 4D.
Well, if you talk about the Galeazzi, a bit of an interesting story is that they didn't match very well. But now people agree that it's a 4D thing which is imprecise.
No? Yeah.
We can see where they got it from.
Okay, but for real time processes, it's a whole new game, right?
I will argue not so much. Not so much. That is why I spent so much time on this.
Okay, well. What do you want to do now?
I think everybody needs a coffee.
Okay. Huh? Also, despite what is on the schedule, which I think they copied from some old version, we're only going to have two talks a week, a day. So,
okay.
Afternoon if you want to.
Right. So, we stop at 12. You don't.
Oh, was it off before?
I have put it on. Now to the real topic after this this long introduction. I've never taken this kind of freedom before, but thanks to the hospitality of Bill, I'm taking the most. So it is about real-time correlation functions in the classical limits that I would like to talk about. The original proposal was to take classical equations, period, but it was already quickly found out that you need some corrections, especially from hard thermal loops, to make this thing work for you, and it is not entirely clear, and I would like also to bring this in for the discussion, whether from classical type of correlation functions you can indeed find transport coefficients in the conventional sense, namely transport coefficients that determine, for example, viscosity, etc., for you. I have no final answer on that, but I hope that we can get to that during the rest of this week. Another point of discussion I should think is the following. In this classical approach to real-time correlation functions, it seems that there are two major approaches which depend on the sort of splitting that is being made to get your effective theory. There is the procedure, the very straightforward procedure, to split the real-time field in two parts that are below a certain momentum cutoff and above, and then try to construct an effective theory that only describes the low momentum modes. We have had many talks about it, and it has been initiated certainly also by Dietrich in a paper from 1995. The other group, and the Amsterdam group fits that category, there's another type of splitting which I call classical versus quantum. What we do is take as a basic field a classical field that you could see as the real-time extension of the dimensionally reduced field. That is, I will explain later, but that is the main philosophy about it. And the main reason, there are a number of reasons for doing this, but the main reason is not to introduce a cutoff if we can help it. Especially in applications in gate theories, of course, it is complicated to have some cutoff that has to separate between soft and hard mode. Also, it's so that when you split in soft and hard modes, you have to prove that the dynamics of the soft mode indeed follows a classical equation of motion. While here, so to speak, we define the classical field as obeying classical equations of motion.
Are you now going back to the four-dimensional theory in time, or are you talking about working in the three-dimensional reduced theory?
No. Let's start from the beginning and try now to calculate next transparency, just to indicate how what we are doing, in my view. I have a background in statistical physics, and I see this construction of the classical approximation to a real-time correlation function as a reduction of the description. Like, for example, one does in ordinary statistical mechanics, trying to find an effective equation that describes a correlation function between two observables. And I present this sheet because I want to indicate that you, from this sort of reasoning, already know what to expect when you are going to reduce your description from a full description, say that this is the equivalent of your full quantum field theory, that would then be in quantum mechanics or classical mechanics, the Liouville equation, to something that describes your correlation function that you are really interested in, here written as a expectation value
of the time evolution of the Liouville operator. This correlation function has only to do with a certain type of observables. Perhaps in the hydrodynamic regime these observables are just the particle density and energy density. Anyway, there is what you try to do is to reduce the number of degrees of freedom substantially, and you can view that as a projection, and you can even make it work formally for you with the help of the Swanson-Himori theory. But what you then get out, and that is what the point I would like to make, what you also expect to get when you are reducing your description in a quantum field theory, is that you then find an effective equation of motion for your quantity that you're really interested in, the correlation function, whatever it may be. And you typically will find two contributions. One that is in the in statistical mechanics used the frequency matrix contribution. That is essentially the mean field contribution. That is, so to say, the projected part of the full Liouville operator on the space that you are only interested in. And in principle, if you could leave this term out, this would give you a completely closed description in your reduced space. But of course, somewhere you have to also see these other degrees of freedom, and they are in what is called, usually called, the memory kernel. Depends. This is a non-local kernel in time. You can write it as a formal expression like this, and it gives you then, this, the dot means time derivative. In the case that, for example, hydrodynamics, you would replace the dot, the derivative, by the corresponding current. You see that there's a current-current correlation function with a Liouville operator here that is modified now because it only works in the space outside of what you're really interested in. And this modified kernel then would give you, in the static limit, if that is appropriate, transport coefficients, because transport coefficients are nothing else than the time integral of this memory kernel. And it is expected because you project out now the Liouville operator, that this Liouville operator gets an imaginary part, and this imaginary part essentially determines your transport coefficients. So in my view, any reduction of the description will always lead you to something like this, where you have a memory kernel to take into account, but it is essential to take it into account if you want to have, if you are interested in transport coefficients. If you only stay with an effective theory that is mean field, then of course won't see these memory effects, which in the Boltzmann equation would mean a collision term. Okay, I start now with real-time field theory, just a few formulas to remind you how that works. Instead of only going down on the time contour in imaginary time, we now extend it from some initial time to a final time, but because I have to end up anyway here in equilibrium, I also have to return path, and these two additional real-time parts of the contour are usually denoted by C1 and C2. The initial condition of the system is given by the initial density matrix on the initial time up here. I assume equilibrium, that means that I'm only looking at equilibrium time correlation functions. There's a time difference, but I assume always the state that they start off to be in equilibrium. And then I know that I can write the generating functional for all of the real-time correlation functions as a path integral, which is given by the Lagrangian, a coupling to a source so that they will be able to generate the correlation functions on the various parts of the contour. And the initial state is taken into account by an additional integration over the contour down in the imaginary plane. And to make it work, I have to take the trace effect, that this is a trace, into account by imposing boundary conditions, which for my 5 to the 4th model will be periodic. And it's important to say that this boundary, these boundary conditions are between the initial point here and the final point there. There is no boundary condition on this part of the contour, only over the whole contour. And then what I'm also not going to do, as is usual in real-time field theory, is push this part of the contour to infinity so that I have only left these two pieces and do real-time thermal field theory, because the important point is, of course, to keep an initial condition in.
You're drawing here just this contour. Why do you need a boundary condition? That's what you choose yourself to do?
No, because the initial condition is still, of course, the trace over the thermal weight, and that imposes your initial conditions, like in the Euclidean formulation.
If you have an initially thermal ensemble, then this is the thing to do.
You need to do this.
You don't have to have an initial thermal ensemble. This is the conditions appropriate for that ensemble. Right.
You can also take an equilibrium theory only in Euclidean space. The only thing that I'm now doing here really is deforming the contour instead of going directly down, first to go here and there. So that's another way of seeing how this boundary condition must be in.
I'm just commenting that this comes from the initial condition that it's determined. But for example, the stuff that we've done and the dispersion.
You try to do more general.
Any initial condition you like. There's no such condition.
But then you keep explicitly your density matrix and have to specify your density matrix in some taken into account. Yeah.
In your topmost module on the field transfer, the final time does not appear.
No, the final time is taken at infinity.
I mean, you're studying non-equal time correlation functions.
In thermal equilibrium. And they will only depend on the time difference, of course.
So the time difference. Time is assumed to be larger than any time appearing in the
observer. So in the usual case, there will be some correlation time, and the correlation function will only depend on time over this correlation time and drop to zero farther out. So this final time should not matter. It should not matter in this case. Simplifies it. In particular, then for the fourth theory that I'm going to use, has the same contour. Then the generated functional has the usual form, except that I'm now also going to keep the integration over the momentum, because I want to model this as a classical field average, and that means that I want an average of a field and of a momenta, so I keep that in 2. And of course, all the integrations over the contour involve the up, the part going up, a part going down, and also a part going down the imaginary time axis. And I'm not going to throw that away too quickly. What I'm after is to model the theory as much as possible as a classical theory, which means that in an ideal situation I would at the end be left with a generating functional that would have a thermal weight at the initial time. These capital phi and pi now mean the fields at the initial time, only spatially dependent. They define for me my initial condition, and I have to trace over these fields to take the trace over the average weight. With classical fields that evolve in real time according to some well-defined classical equations of motion. That would be that I would call really the classical limit of my field theory. And the question is, how close can you get to such a formulation of your field theory? And in this sense, there is a reduction of the description if it were possible to model the field theory in this way.
That's just a reminder, that's not exactly the definition I use.
To?
In my talk.
Oh, sorry, okay, I was not there.
To
match this. That will be the theme of today. We're going to match everything with everything. Now, how do I try to make this now, my field theory, look as much as possible like this? I introduce the constraint effective action for this particular case. And how do I do that? I follow really the same scheme as I did for the static case. These initial fields I put simply in the path integration by writing two delta functions for them. I project the quantum fields on the zero modes on the Euclidean part of the contour. I'm not going to project on the real part. I only take out the piece on the imaginary part, and just as I did that before, I define the zero modes out of these fields. Because I do that, because I want to use my dimensionally reduced fields as initial conditions for the classical equations of motion. That is the whole philosophy behind this scheme. Which means I introduce the classical field, which on the imaginary contour simply equal to the initial condition. And then I let the field run according to some equation of motion. I come back to that in a minute, how you can choose this equation of motion. It will not be a completely classical equation of motion. And I do the same then for my other variable that I have, because I want to have this initial condition. But in fact, on the real-time part of the contour, the classical momentum is simply put equal to the time derivative of the classical field. So it is not a separate degree of freedom on the real-time contour. And I do really basically the same now with my path integral. I introduce in this way an additional integration over the initial state. And what I then get out, of course, is if I do that, I can rewrite a full generating functional as an integral over the initial state, plus everything, of course, that is still in the action, but I can easily work out what will be in my action. Let's go back to this transparency. I have, it is the usual thing of splitting field in the background and the quantum field, so they get exactly what you expect. In this case, you get a sum of three terms. One contribution is simply the action for the classical fields, of course, and you have the interaction between the classical field with the quantum field, also as expected. The only difference with the dimensionally reduced case is that you now have explicitly a linear term to take into account. Stated differently, you should add to this a vertex with only one non-static line and three classical lines, really, to this. But we prefer to keep it as a source term. But it doesn't matter how you do it, as long as you take that into account.
So far, the classical fields can be arbitrarily hard.
Yes, and I will, and that will be part of the discussion, how to handle that. They are classical fields, but not necessarily confined to the slow modes. That depends very much on the initial conditions. Now, by these manipulations, what I construct is a thermal ensemble, really, because the classical action immediately simplifies. I take
because the classical fields on the up contour and the down contour are the same, they drop out from the classical action, and the only contribution to the classical action comes from the imaginary contour. But there, of course, the classical action is simply the Hamiltonian of the system in terms of the initial values of the fields. These initial values of the fields are, of course, only spatially dependent, have no time dependence in them, so the action immediately reduces to the Hamiltonian. And I have then already my thermal weight here. I have my integral over the initial state. But of course, everything that that is interesting has now been put into a quantity that I call the real-time constraint effective action, which is just like the static effective action. It is something that you define by integrating out first over all the quantum modes, leaving your classical degree of freedom as free field still in there. And then, if you were able to do this exactly, you would find in the end a generating functional that was indeed of the form of a integral over initial states, with your classical fields running according to some equation of motion. The important thing about this whole construction is the same as in static dimensional reduction, namely, you expect that this will work in perturbation theory. So this constraint effective action that you have here should be expandable in the coupling constants for the same reasons as you could do that in static dimensional reduction, namely, the dangerous modes are projected out. They are the static modes and their real-time extension in the classical fields. These fields should contain the infrared divergences, and you expect that this part of the whole thing could be expanded in the coupling constant, just as before. And for that, of course, you need to if you want to do perturbation theory, you have to find out what the propagator is for this part. So you have to calculate the constraint effective action without interaction first. And that is just an ordinary path integral, except for these constraints that project out the classical part of the field. Still, you can do this integral, and what you then find is that this gives rise to a propagator, which is nearly the thermal propagator that you find as usual in the real-time field theory, a propagator that's defined over the whole contour. This is the exact expression that that you find in any text on real-time field theory. But that's not everything. You find that there is now subtraction, and the subtraction is very easily identified because it is in fact nothing else than the high temperature limits of the thermal contour propagator. In other words, you simply get that result by subtracting from the Bose distribution function its classical limits at the most dangerous limits, and calling that together and wiggle. And then what you are left with, this part, gives rise to the classical propagator of the system, which I have written down here. You have to work out how it looks like on the various parts of the contour, but on the real-time part of the contour, it is just the classical propagator given by temperature over frequency squared times the cosine. And that is where, whenever t and t prime are anywhere on the real-time part of the contour, either on the upper part C1 or the lower part C2. But there is, of course, also there are in principle connections between
these various parts of the contour. I call this one 3-3, and you have to work out what it is. No, it's given by this. More interesting is when the contour propagator is completely confined to this part of the contour. What do you find then for this subtraction? It is simply the propagator that corresponds to the static mode. That is what you have to subtract. And if I forget all these real part stuff, I'm back to static dimensional reduction, because then this is nothing else than the non-static the propagator for the non-static modes that has to be on all internal lines. So in principle, I have a very simple prescription for calculating my constraint effective action in this case. I have vertices that include interactions between the classical field and the quantum field. And I have a propagator, which is nearly the thermal propagator, but with the high temperature part subtracted out. And that is the reason that I expect that this will work in perturbation theory. And without doing any approximation, I have already been able to write my full generating functional as a classical average. The classical average is the average over the initial condition with thermal weight. And then in the exponent, I have the source term that I would hope to find, a source coupled to the classical fields, plus all the complicated rest, which is, I have called, confined in this constraint effective action. And it's the same here as in the static case. You have to do something, of course, to make this work for you. You have to find some approximation. However, some formal aspects of this. When you take simply the source equal to zero in this expression, then what you find out is that on these real-time contours, really nothing is happening. You go up and you go down, and there is no term, if you have no source, that distinguishes between this term and that term. There's a relative minus sign between these two contributions, and you find that, in fact, everything on C1 cancels against everything on C2, and that the only thing that you're left with is the contour C3, which means that if you take simply the source equal to zero, this complicated expression reduces to the constraint effective action that I defined for you in static dimensional reduction. And all the diagrams that you have to calculate them for this thing live only here on this part of the contour. So that's the case when you take external source equal to zero. The second thing you could do is take the first derivative, the tadpole term. I have not yet defined what this classical field is going to be, and it seems very obvious what I'm going to do. I simply impose that the first derivative is respect to the source, at source equal to zero, that this is going to be zero. I'm going to extremize this, so to speak, with respect to the classical field. And that will then be my equation of motion for the classical field, which indeed turns out to be what you expect, namely an equation of motion of the standard form, given by a variation of the classical action, minus, put here a minus sign, plus an effective action. Effective action, it is exactly as in the static dimensional case, not exactly the effective action. It is the effective action that you calculate with the new propagator. So you have to take into account that you have to subtract in the propagator the classical contribution, but then you can calculate this this effective action in the usual manner,
and there is only one vertex involved, because there is no coupling in the equation of motion with this vertex, with the classical field. If you go to a simple example and do linear response, that means look at what this gives you when you only keep the classical field, then it's quite obvious what comes out of this. You find the classical equation of motion as is given by the classical action. Then you find, I keep here only the linear field, the contribution from the two-point function. I have to take the integral over the whole contour, so I go up and I go down, and the up and down part together give me precisely the retarded retarded two-point function in this case. And what I find is a piece that comes from third part of the contour. And I have an initial condition, of course. I have to solve this classical field equation with the initial condition that I impose, namely that it is equal to some spatial field, and later on I then average over that.
What is the superscript to?
A two-point.
Two-point.
Only two-point, not two-loop or whatever. And the subscript means that it is Hellquist's contribution of time one, which is somewhere here on this contour, and time three, which is on this part of the contour. So it's a mixed contribution. What you find out when you do the calculations, you see that you get a something that you could expect. The two-point function is dominated, like in the static case, by the Hart-Thoma loop contribution, and in fact you find exactly the same Hart-Thoma loop contribution for this. I have left out the term with the cutoff. I should have written that out too, perhaps. But the interesting thing about this is that the Hart-Thoma loop contributions are in, but it's one thing that's not in here, and that has to do with the fact that I'm using a different propagator. I'm using a propagator where the classical part is extracted. And this means the following. If you now go to a two-loop calculation and you calculate the on-shell damping rate, which has been done by Gert and by Jan, then you see, and that has been noted by Gert and Jan, that this damping rate, you can get the damping rate out of a classical theory or out of the quantum theory in leading order. This damping rate is the same. But in my propagator, I'm subtracting quantum from classical from quantum, which means that in my self-energy, this damping rate to leading order will not be contained. So this is a linear response equation, but to leading order, damping results are not included, because I still have to calculate my correlation function with the initial condition, and it's going to appear there. It's not going to appear in the equation of motion. So, to make the point, I'm not getting a stochastic equation of motion for the classical field, because I project out all these pieces, and I put all the pieces that give me dissipation, etc., later on in the real-time correlation function. That is a difference with the approach where you make a separation in hard and soft mode, because then, of course, in your memory kernels, there will appear traces of your hard modes, and you will find, for example, you can translate that into noise terms.
That once again, I'm getting a bit lost. I mean, this is supposed to be an exact equation for linear response.
For linear response.
But then you calculate the two-point function in some perturbation theory.
This two-point function, yeah. because it is, you use this subtracted propagator, you expect that you can calculate this thing in perturbation theory. Yes? You so far with me? You do the tadpole, then the leading term gives you simply our thermal loop contribution. Then you go to two loop to see what happens with the dissipation that you expect to appear in the self-energy at that order. And then you find out, because this damping rate to leading order is classical as well as quantum, and you can get it out of the classical theory.
So what is damping rate exactly? You're doing the calculation at higher loops in the quantum theory? Or you're doing...
Yeah. I'm doing that. Yeah.
So what is the classical calculation one compares that with?
That has been done by Gert. Then that is using only the classical propagators and the retarded propagator, for that matter, to calculate, for example, the contributions to the sun, setting sun diagram. So this
that means what? Throwing away the one in the quantum statistical
thing? Okay, throwing away the Bose distribution function and replacing that by T over omega. And the ones also. Yeah, so it's the high temperature limit. And in fact, in this diagram, you calculated them by putting here the classical propagator and one retarded, if I...
This holds for this diagram only, or something more general?
Well, I'll help you. Okay, but anyway... right.
What are the typical loop methods which give you this
Would not appear either. Yeah. Perhaps that is the point, yes. I would not appear either.
The top equation.
Yeah, that could be. You expect that to happen? You know that it happens? That it does not happen? I'm not...
I think your point was more in the sense of Greiner and Müller's paper, where they integrate out half most, and this always leads to some noise and damping.
But not this specific damping.
Probably some higher order.
Yeah, it is the collision, Boltzmann collision type of. That's a good point. Right.
Why is this damping not in that retarded propagator? I thought it was.
This one?
Yeah.
It's not in here because I explicitly subtracted this type of things. I'm using a propagator, which I call delta, which is the full thermal propagator, but it explicitly subtracted this classical term. So in my calculation of this thing, this combination will not occur.
So the remaining three dimensional theory has to solve.
Right, and it's in there.
So I'm supposed to ignore that equation on the top.
No, because this is the equation of motion that you have to use to define your classical field on the real-time contour.
But it doesn't give you the correct answer.
Only after integration of the initial conditions.
Somehow that is what you would want. You want a real-time correlation function that gives you the physics, and this classical field is used as an intermediary stage for doing the calculations, but it is a discussion point whether it makes sense to do it this way or somehow to introduce damping terms in this theory. And in fact, there have been already a long time ago proposals to do just that, because what I'm now in effect doing is the same as in static dimensional reduction. I'm now going to simplify this this complicated effective equation of motion to the basics that I still trust, which means if I only take local terms into account in my static part, then I also should take local terms into account in my equations of motion. And in fact, you can argue that these must be the same, because I want my Hamiltonian on the imaginary part giving me the statistical weight, and here giving me the time evolution to be the same. And that is what we think is the correct procedure in real-time dimensional reduction, that is that these coefficients by matching relations in the equation of motion have to be fit to the full theory exactly in the same way as that is done in static dimensional reduction, that the same coefficients are going to appear here. And there is a formal argument I would not call it really a proof as yet, although it seems very plausible. You know that you can get from the imaginary time to the real time by analytic continuation in an equilibrium theory. And in particular, you know that coefficients that are defined in terms of retarded functions, that you get that from analytic continuation of green functions in imaginary time. So it seems plausible, and it has been checked to loop order, that exactly the vertex functions that you need here, which you have to calculate from a retarded vertex function, are exactly the same in the zero energy limit as the static dimensional reduction vertex functions that you would calculate for static dimensional reduction. I will not claim that this is a proof yet. There is a subtlety involved because of the propagator that we use is different. So if this were just calculated as usual with the thermal propagator, and this would be just Euclidean field theory, then it's a theorem. Then it's a theorem that the zero frequency part of the retarded vertex function, and it goes for the higher ones too, is exactly the same as the static correlation and vertex function that you would calculate here. Retarded here, static here, match. That's a theorem. But I'm using this subtracted propagator. Not 90% sure, but not 100% sure, that the analytic continuation argument that one usually uses to derive these relationships is still valid. You need the spectral representation for these things to do the analytic continuation and to see how it comes out. But given the two-loop calculations, at least, it seems very plausible. But there have been other proposals. There's an old proposal of Matsumoto and Lanzmann to treat these coefficients as independent, new phenomenological variables, and somehow introduce already dissipation at this stage. So you introduce a mass that has an imaginary part and that has to be fitted somehow. And how do you fit it? You fit it to something you can calculate, for example, a viscosity coefficient. There's a different proposal that it does not fit, I think, with the argument presented here, but some people have tried to work this further out to make that work, but I don't think that this is entirely consistent at the moment, so as it is presented. And of course, you have the approach where you get some noise terms in here. Kreiner and Müller, for example, give a derivation of this effective equation of motion, and then you get noise terms here, simply from the memory kernel, and they take that seriously and into account in this equation. But what we propose is to be as close to static dimensional reduction as possible and keep these coefficients as they appear in static dimensional reduction, so that in principle you can calculate these coefficients there, and you don't need a separate calculation for this. Now, I think I'm not going into detail how to work this. We can always, if there are questions about it, do that later. I want to cut this short in the following way. We have a formal expression that gives, in principle, correlation functions as classical averages. We hope now that we are able to calculate the lowest order coefficients that you need to define the equations of motion by perturbation theory. But is that then enough? And just to see what it gives, these formulae are not important except for one thing. This is the formula you get by simply rewrite it in this constraint effective action form. But if you now look at the two-point function, you see that you get the exact two-point function. You see that you get two contributions from this. One is what you would call classical. It's a classical average over classical fields, where you have to calculate the time dependence using these effective equations of motion. Plus, of course, the rest that makes up the difference between a classical and a quantum thing. And you could wonder whether it would be possible simply to drop the second part. And that is not the case, because, for example, Hartzell-Malouf contributions have been shown to be important in this case. And also, you need your damping coefficients come in. I'm going a bit fast here, but just to give you the flavor of what you expect now to happen is the following. You find out that it's not sufficient simply to take the most naive type of classical correlation functions and substitute that for the correlation function you had. That won't work. Also, it won't work for if you want to calculate transport coefficients, because they're sensitive to the quantum modes in some respect. But what you can do is you can now, because you have the full theory, you can look what the next correction is going to be, and what you find out is that you can structure that a bit. You can define a Dyson-Swinger equation that includes the sort of corrections that you're after. And what you now typically are going to find when you are going to calculate the corrections is, I think, here the best way to look. That is, you get retarded. You expand everything in coupling constants. You assume that you are allowed to do this. So you get retarded propagators, but what you also get whatever you calculate is averages of classical fields in some configuration. For example, if you calculate correction to the classical self-energy, if I might call it that way, then what I find, I have here two points. The points here are contracted to 1 point. But let's say a four-field classical expectation value to calculate to get certain physical observables, and I just worked this out for in phi to the fourth, where I can replace these things also by perturbative expressions, and then I find, for example, the plasmon damping rate that is now in. I had to calculate plasmon damping rate still. Here it is. And it comes out via my classical field by calculating this sort of expressions. So the classical field is everywhere in the corrections, but it comes up in a very systematic way, in such a manner that, in principle at least, if I see that just an ordinary classical correlation function won't do, that I will be able to, in phi to the fourth theory, we will discuss K theories later, how to find out what the corrections look like and see whether I can do something with that. The whole object of the game is, of course, that this type of quantities are, in gauge theories, non-perturbative. So you should not try to calculate this in perturbation theory. But then you have confined the problems to this sort of correlation functions, and the hope is then that you can find out by some other means how these look like, and then you can combine that in the total expression, for example, to calculate a damping rate. Okay, I have been short on this part because we see this afternoon how this works for gate theory, which of course is much more interesting. But what I wanted to bring over is that static dimensional reduction can in some way be extended over the real-time axis, provided you assume that the coupling constant is weak. You get then, in principle, a method for calculating quantum corrections when the pure classical correlation function won't do. For example, the transport coefficient or the plasmon damping rate. And that's the claim, at least. Matching to static dimensional reduction makes the theory free of artificial cutoff dependent terms, and that works both for the power ultraviolet divergences as the logarithmic divergences. And what we then see as the important thing in doing this kind of analysis is that the classical theory, at least, keeps the local symmetries on the real-time axis, because we have not introduced any cutoff that can spoil this this type of important symmetries. I think this is the point to break. I suppose that discussion, we do that later, and go to lunch. Okay. Thank you.